to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman.
Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Jamie, and welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. It's so nice to have you here today. You guys, every time you download these episodes, when you leave reviews on Apple Podcasts, when you share these around the world, you really help us get this message out to more people. So thank you for each and every time you guys have done that for me. I really appreciate it. Well, I have an awesome guest from across the world on today's podcast. It's always fun recording with people in other time zones, trying to figure out. We practice daylight savings time here in Nebraska. So it's like half the year, there's this time difference and half the year. And what an awful experiment on humans daylight savings time is. But I'm super excited to welcome Dr. Anthony Chafee to the podcast today. Welcome, Doc.
Hey, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how we got here today, because you are American born, but you live in Australia. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So I'm an American doctor, but I practice here in Australia. I played rugby since I was a teenager and always loved traveling. And so I took about 10 years off between undergrad and medical school to play professional rugby. Went to New Zealand, Europe, South Africa, played all over the place, but never quite made it to Australia. And I was always really interested in checking it out just because of the rugby connection. And so after I became a doctor, I actually left my training program for a family emergency and was helping my parents for a couple of years. Because my dad got diagnosed with Parkinson's and then cancer and just needed to be home for a while. But thankfully, everything is fine now. After that, I was doing humanitarian work in Bangladesh and volunteering as a doctor in the refugee camps there with the Rohingya refugees that came across from Burma. I don't know if many people are aware of this, but in 2017, there was an actual genocide in Burma where the government killed about unofficially 200,000 people and a million people fled into Bangladesh. And they were quite desperate for help because, obviously there's just a lot of people, and also not many people were going over to help because ISIS was very active in Bangladesh at the time. And it was just a very, very dangerous place to be. So that discouraged a lot of people from going, which is actually why I felt compelled to go, because there just wasn't enough help. It wasn't like, Haiti or Nepal, when there was an abundance of people going over and helping. And I didn't feel any need to go because there was already more than enough people, probably too many people in those places. And I felt I would just be taking up resources. But in Bangladesh, there was the opposite problem. So after I finished up with that, and I was looking to rejoin a residency, get back into hospital work, I was just looking around, and I had friends in Australia who were practicing here and really liked it and thought that I would like it, and so they encouraged me to come down, and so I just decided to check it out, and I'm glad I did. It's a very, very nice place to be. While we're here today is basically because around that same time when I got back from Bangladesh, I looked more into diet and nutrition, and specifically into the fact that, biologically humans are carnivores. That's the kind of animal that we are. And I started looking at medicine from that perspective, that we're biologically carnivores, but we're not eating as such. And so we're getting health problems related to an improper diet. Just like any zookeeper will tell you, if you feed an animal something that it doesn't eat in the wild, something it didn't evolve on, it gets very, very sick. But what do they get sick with? They get obesity, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, liver disease, arthritis, autoimmune disorders. They get all the same things that we do. And dogs and cats are known carnivores, and yet we give them grain and plant-based kibble, and they get the same things as well. And the prevalence of these diseases have increased quite dramatically in recent decades as well, since the pet food industry has taken off. Because before the 1980s, it wasn't really... but most people were feeding their animals table scraps and things like that, and so it wasn't as much of a problem. And I remember seeing a statistic where, like, in the 1970s and before, the average age of a golden retriever in America was 17 years, where now it's 9 years. And people will blame the kennels breeding these things, concentrated breeding, but these things were already pure breeds. So I don't really see how that's going to change. And in not that many generations, dogs obviously have higher generation rate than humans do, but still it's not that much time. And, anyone who studied population genetics would understand that that's a very hard thing to do, to change an entire population where their life expectancy would be halved like that. That would be a very difficult thing to do. So I got more and more interested in this and did a lot more research into it and started asking questions. You know, if we are carnivores and plants are detrimental to our health and sugar is detrimental to our health in certain ways, you know, we should be seeing these sorts of things in the literature. So I started asking questions and looking at what the literature said and finding that this, you know, had some merit to it. I originally became interested in this just because obviously being, you know, having an athletic background, I was always very interested in what was the best fuel for myself and coming from, you know,
back when you trained, you know, as an athlete, professional athlete was, I mean, I'm assuming you guys had nutritionists or, you know, people that were trying to get you to get healthy. I played collegiate athletics, but they literally told us to eat the rainbow. Like that's what they told us.
Yeah. And they're still telling us that, you know, my team in Seattle that I played with is now in the Major League Rugby League, the Seattle Seawolves, and do very, very well. You know, they won the first two championships, the inaugural championships. You know, they have the same sort of thing. They have these strength and health coaches that, you know, work with them, but also talk about diet and are still very traditional, you know, dietary outlook. And I try to talk to people on the side, be like, no, it's really not what you want to do. Just cut all the carbs, don't eat any plants, just eat meat and fat. And the people that are doing it are having, you know, fantastic results. Yeah. Because, you know, this is a demonstrable, repeatable event. And so when I was first playing professionally, when I was in my sort of late teens, early 20s, I took cancer biology at the University of Washington. I was still in university. I started university early, but this was sort of when I was still in it. And I learned that, you know, plants use natural defenses, obviously, because they're living organisms. And so all living organisms have a defense. And while animals can run away or fight back, plants can't. And so one of their main defenses is chemical deterrence, make you physically sick so that you don't want to eat that plant. This is, you know, we talk about edible and inedible plants. You know, most plants are inedible, meaning that they will make you extremely sick or even kill you. Well, this is even the so-called edible plants, you know, still have that mode of protection. They're not completely without chemical protection. It's just that we have more defenses towards those poisons. We're able to break those down a little more safely, but these things will build up. So slow poison is still poison, and they will build up and build up and build up. And what I've come to realize is that the so-called chronic diseases that we treat, you know, heart disease, diabetes, certainly autoimmune disorders, even blood pressure, all of these things are not, I wouldn't call them diseases per se. I would say that these are actually toxicities, the toxic buildup of a species inappropriate diet, and then a lack of species appropriate nutrition. Alzheimer's, dementia, you can lump into that category as well. You're getting, you know, we're calling it now type 3 diabetes. You have, you know, peripheral insulin resistance, and that's affecting your brain as well. And you put people on like a ketogenic or carnivore diet, all of a sudden their brain's running on ketones and just wake up. And also, you know, we're starving our brain for nutrients. Our brain's made of very long chain fatty acids, 20 and 22 chain fatty acids, DHA, EPA. These things don't come from plants. We don't really make them very well ourselves. We have to get them from our diet, but everyone's put on a low fat, heart healthy diet, and their brains are atrophying. And we think of this as normal, but if you look before the 1980s, this was not normal at all. This was very abnormal. And people say, well, we probably just weren't noticing it. If you've ever had a family member or a patient with Alzheimer's or dementia, you would notice it. And so this is not a credible assertion that we just, you know, just people were just too stupid before the 1980s. They just couldn't pay attention to what was in front of them. Yeah.
Do you think when your dad was dying of cancer and Parkinson's, was this something that you were like thinking about at the time? Or like, what's your perspective like now? I don't know what your dad's health was like, you know, across his lifespan, but.
Yeah. Well, he's very healthy now, but, you know, and he was always very conscious of his health, you know, never drank, never smoked. He was a student of the Pritikin movement. And people don't know what that is. It was, you know, it was very low fat diet, but also low sugar and a lot of other things, but everyone focuses on the low fat. And that certainly was a big part of that, but there were other things as well. And I would say that, you know, getting rid of the sugar, that was a major component of helping people get away from heart disease, as and that the getting rid of the fat was actually harmful, and it is. And so he's doing much better. And he was overall in fairly good health, but he was having blood pressure issues, and he had this lung cancer, not non-smoke, you know, he wasn't a smoker, but he got adenocarcinoma and just caught it incidentally. And thankfully was able to take that out with a partial lobectomy and didn't need to go forward from there. So that's been very lucky. But that's definitely in my mind. And he has actually been on a carnivore diet for the last 4 or so years, and his health has been improved dramatically. His, he was getting very bad memory issues, and he was actually getting a bit more confused in conversations, which is very hard to see because he was a brilliant man. He was a physicist at the Lawrence Livermore Radiation Laboratory at Berkeley with Luis Alvarez, on his team that invented the bubble chamber and started studying subatomic particles. And Luis Alvarez ended up getting the Nobel Prize for that. My father was on his team since he was 17 years old. You know, he got the job over PhDs in physics who applied for that job, and they picked him. He was a high school kid. And so he was a very, very brilliant man, and seeing him have difficulty just in normal conversations was very hard to see. But 2 months on a high fat carnivore diet, it was like he was just his old self again. Yeah. And it was really, really nice to see.
I remember when I was first getting into ketogenic therapy within my own practice, there is a guy, Ryan Lowry, that works at the American Sports and Performance Institute in Tampa, Florida. And they do incredible testing on like high level athletes, like put these sensors and they watch how their bodies move in motion. They do a lot of body comp testing, a lot of metabolic testing. And I remember he posted this video on this Parkinson's patient. They brought him in and put all these sensors, and they were like watching his tremors, and they put him in therapeutic ketosis and then showed like the after video. And you couldn't have paid me to believe this man had Parkinson's. It was like, wow. Like it's incredible what the brain can do when you give it an alternative fuel source. And, has your dad ever experimented with exogenous ketones, or he just does great with his diet? Things are good.
Yeah, no, he hasn't taken exogenous ketones. Yeah. He just does just pure just meat and water. And that's it. And he's done very well. You know, his Parkinson's was pretty early on in its progression. So he didn't have, as bad of a time as other people do. He had a very slight tremor, and but he had different sorts of testing and imaging showing that he was actually losing the dopamine centers of his brain, and he had certainly some early signs of Parkinsonism, but he basically has no signs of these things now. Mm-hmm. And it's been four plus years at this point. And he's doing very, very well. And my mom was a type 2 diabetic for something like 25 years, 2 months on a high fat carnivore diet. She was on 3 oral medications. She came off all of those, and she reduced her lantus from 64 down to 14 in 2 months. And her HbA1c went from 8.9 down to 6.1. And if you don't know what that is, it's a 3-month marker of your glucose control, your blood sugar control. And 8.9 is quite high. Yeah. And 6.1 is high normal for a non-diabetic. And so that was a very dramatic difference. And her doctor was quite amazed by this and wanted to talk to me about like, okay, what the hell is going on here? And like, how the hell did you do this? She said that. She said, how the hell did you do this?
Yeah.
What the hell did you do? This diabetes is a progressive disorder. It only gets worse where you can try and slow it down and mitigate it with lifestyle, diet, and medications, but it only gets worse. It doesn't just go away in 2 months. But, if this is an actual poison, exposure relationship, then removing the exposure, you're going to reverse most of the problems. And that's actually what we're seeing in practice. Same with autoimmune disorders. I mean, you get someone with, we have Dr. Salisbury, of the Salisbury Steak, did a 30-year research project in the 1800s looking at the optimal diet for human beings, wrote a book called, I think it was like the relation between alimentation and disease. So that, what you eat, causes these diseases. And he was finding that you could reverse things like rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, gout, just by putting people on a pure red meat and water diet. And people have rediscovered this, not necessarily through his work, but just in general. They've tried different elimination diets and found that they can control their rheumatoid arthritis or their Crohn's or their gout There are different studies looking at elemental diets and fasting mimicking diets that have better efficacy than prednisone in flare-ups for Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. You know, and it gets people out of flare-ups faster, and it keeps them in remission longer than even, you know, these crazy medications that are quite harmful to people as well when they're taken long term, certainly steroids. And quite a lot of people, you know, my patients and people that I've spoken to, they completely reversed their Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And even when they get, you know, biopsy, they're like, we have no sign of disease at this point. You know, so it really does show an exposure sort of relationship, and you get rid of that exposure and these things go away.
Yeah, it's incredible when I am just working on a patient's diet just because they want to lose weight, but then they'll come in and they're like, yeah, my ankles don't hurt. I'm not having headaches. I had this weird skin thing and it totally cleared up. It's pretty incredible to watch those things. And it's like, you can't deny like these real world examples. It's pretty incredible. And obviously, you know, but for our listeners, the presence of ketone bodies in the bloodstream inhibits the NLRP3 inflammasome. So basically it's a fantastic way to dampen inflammation through all these different pathways. Okay. So tell me why neurosurgery, right? You're a neurosurgeon. Is that right?
Well, yeah, neurosurgical resident. Yeah. I'm still training.
How did you end up down that path?
I was always interested in so many different kinds of medicine. I really like surgery. I like being involved in the OR. That's sort of my happy place. And so I've really loved all the different sorts of fields that I've been in, but neurosurgery, I always kept coming back to neurosurgery. I was really fascinated by this. You know, my first few months in medical school, we were doing different clinical rotations and really just following people around the hospital, you know, and watching surgeries and you know, different things. I think I was assigned to general surgery, and that was fine. But then I ended up going into a neurosurgery case after hours. There was a trauma. A woman had got kicked in the face by a horse, and they had to sort of reconstruct her frontal sinuses and orbit, you know, from, you know, outside and inside. And when they opened her up and then showed all this thing, I was just really amazed. And I was like, wow, you know, underneath that, like that's her brain. Like that's who she is. That's everything that makes her who she is just right there. I was just very fascinated by that organ. And the next day I was like, okay, I'm going to go and see some more neurosurgery cases. And, you know, then, you know, they were doing craniotomies and I was actually seeing the brain. It was just there, just pulsing. So I was like, oh my God, like, I was just really blown away by it. And just thinking about how complex and fascinating that the brain is, it really blew me away. I remember thinking, I was like, you know, there's a place in this person's brain where her, you know, her feelings that she had towards her dog on her 7th birthday exists. And it's a physical place that you can touch it with your finger. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's just amazing. And so I just wanted to learn more and more about it. And I, you know, I just became more and more fascinated with the field and being able to, you know, give someone back their mind and their presence and their ability to think and be a person is you're sort of giving them back part of their humanity. And I just thought that was just a really incredible thing to do for people. And it just became more of an interest for me. And I did other sorts of things and tried different rotations. I was really interested in you know, reconstructive surgery and especially like facial reconstructive surgery for accidents and cancer patients. And I was sort of going back and forth between the two, but I always just kept coming back to neurosurgery. And so ended up just going forward with that.
I'm so fascinated with, like, you know, people's paths and how they get there. And like, everybody always has some kind of like personal story that kind of pushed them, you know, one way or another. But my mom, when I was going to medical school, she said, I don't care what you do, just don't be an OBGYN. That's what she told me. And when I went to medical school, they made us fill out these envelopes and say, when I graduate, I'm going to be a XYZ doctor. And I thought I was going to be an emergency room physician because I grew up in the era of like George Clooney and ER. And like, it was this super sexy job. And then I got into medical school and I was like, oh, that's horrible. Like, I would never want to be an ER doctor. Like, you just triage people and then like send them on their way. You never know what happens. And so then I got into the operating room and I absolutely loved surgery. I loved procedures. I loved doing it. But I had this like in the back of my mind, like, don't be an OBGYN. Like, and then I get to my obstetrics rotation and I just freaking loved it. So despite what my mom told me, I became an OBGYN But we do a lot of surgery. People, I don't think, realize how much surgery we do. Pelvic floor surgery, hysterectomies, and even in clinic, we're doing procedures. But the funny part of this whole story is the man who delivered me, like when I was delivered as a baby, was still practicing in the town that I, where I was training. And so we're operating alongside each other when I was a resident. And so I would joke with the operating room nurses. I'm like, he delivered me. And he used to joke with all the nurses and say, well, if I wouldn't have dropped her on her head, she would have been a neurosurgeon. That's what he said every time. I'm like laughing when you're telling this story, because he always joked that I should have been a neurosurgeon. But I was very happy that obstetrics and gynecology was 4 years, because we started a family in medical school. And so my husband and I were busy doing that. So God bless you for your training. I mean, I guess if somebody's cutting open your brain, they should be training for a long time. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That is pretty wild though. Oh, sorry. Go on.
Yeah.
I was just saying, yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, like sometimes you just sort of think, you're like, this person is going to let me operate on their brain. Like that's pretty crazy that someone would be that trusting towards you. And you have to be trusting. But I've remarked on this with some of my colleagues and some of my bosses. They're just like, yeah, it still amazes me that people actually let us do this to them, you know, that actually let us operate on their brain, because, you know, things can go horribly wrong, and they often don't, but they can. And the way that my head of department describes it is, you know, you put a foot wide plank that's 10 feet long on the ground, walk across it, no problem. Take that same plank, put it 100 feet up in the air, now do it. Okay, it becomes a different thing. It's the same plank, should be just as easy, but the consequences are much, much different. And that's sort of how it is. You know, 95% of the time, everything goes along perfectly. 98% of the time, people don't have a serious disability at the end of it. 99% of the time, they survive. But you know, those are big check marks, and things can go very, very wrong with that. I actually, just as an aside, I actually was interested in OBGYN as well. One of my professors in obstetrics was a professor, Fergal Malone. And he actually came up with twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome surgery. So he did a lot of intrauterine surgery and sort of watching his
guy. Yeah.
It was just fascinating. And so, and he actually, came up with a lot of these surgeries himself. So he was so slick. He was such a skilled surgeon, and that made me really interested in that. And that was a big pull for me as well. But
For me, I was like, well, if I have to drive to the hospital at 3 a.m, I'd rather be delivering a baby than taking out a gallbladder. That was like how I rationalized it in my head. It's fun dealing with like some happy medicine, because most medicine is like doom and gloom these days.
True. Very true.
Okay. So yeah, talk to me about other cancers. So particularly because you're a neurosurgeon, glioblastoma is one of the cancers that seems to be responsive to ketogenic therapy. What are your thoughts about this type of diet and lifestyle and different cancers?
I think that it's definitely something that we need to start looking at as a treatment modality and adjuvant sort of to normal therapies. I wouldn't say we should just do away with chemo and radiation. Those have been proven very, very effective versus, you know, no treatment at all. It may be that at some point we can do away with them, but they do help. And, you know, if you have a glioblastoma and you do nothing, on average, you have a 3-month life expectancy from time of diagnosis. If you do nothing with surgery, chemo and radiation, you have between 18 and 24 months. So that's a significant improvement. And actually, those are the old numbers. The new numbers that we have been collecting over the last several years will actually show longer than that. So we do get better results now. But you know, there are institutions. There's Dr. Thomas Seyfried, who's done this in animal models, looking at GBMs in mice and putting them on a ketogenic diet. And limiting that glutamine. I think he has a medication that actually suppresses that, and is finding that this is actually really helping in these rat models. Then there's a treatment group in, I think it's called Paleo Medicina in Hungary, and they're already treating people with cancers, even GBMs, with a carnivore diet, or at least a high fat ketogenic diet. If the people don't want to go on, they try to get people on a full carnivore diet, but if they don't, they'll at least be ketogenic, and they're finding very, very good results. The director of that, Sophia or Zofria, I'm not remembering correctly, but she was saying that in some interviews I saw with her and some of her research, she was saying that most cancers will just recede quite rapidly. And this is also what Dr. Seyfried is seeing. She said GBM is the one thing that they don't see it shrink, but it doesn't advance. And so they have a number of patients who've had a glioblastoma multiforme, and it's been completely stable for 3.5-4 years, which is just unheard of. I mean, this is the single most aggressive primary brain lesion that exists. It is so aggressive. And, you know, I've seen people who, obviously these things are averages, but, you know, so you see people on both sides of the average of survival. And so you see people that do okay and then make it to chemo radiation. Then you see other people that you resect these tumors and you get basically all of it, everything you can see and get safely. And then you're waiting a couple of weeks for everything to heal up so they can start chemo and radiation. And all of a sudden they come back in, the tumor's three times the size of the one that you took out, and they don't even make it to chemo and radiation. You have to palliate them and just make them comfortable. And that's very frightening. So this is a very, very aggressive tumor. And she's finding that, you know, they don't grow at all when you're on these sorts of diets. When I talk to people, obviously, because we don't have, the big, clinical studies we don't have any really human trials. We have people who are treating this stuff. We don't have any large center or multi-center trials looking at this. So, you know, I can't recommend this as an official recommendation from my department, but whenever I'm counseling someone who has one of these diagnoses, almost always they ask me, what else, what can I do? What can I do to make this better? What can I do to help my situation? And, you know, I always try to tell them, it's like, well, you know, you just be as healthy as you can, help your body fight this off, because your immune system and your body is going to be, you know, the main driver here. And so, well, what can I do? What can I eat? What should I be eating? And I don't feel that it's ethical to not tell them these things and to not tell them, that there are very specific dietary changes, such as going on a ketogenic diet. And I would help, recommend a full carnivore diet. And I just give them resources, and I point them in the way of Dr. Seyfried and the Paleo Medicina, and just say, look, here are some studies. Here are these people. Here are their talks. And here's some data points, and here are some studies looking at ketogenic diet and cancer treatments as well. And then you make your own decision. And there've been a number of people that have taken that on board and have had quite good results. Actually, a good friend of mine was diagnosed with a GBM over 6 years ago. It's going on 7 years now. And I was telling her this at the time, and she didn't go full on it, because she said, well, if I'm going to die, I want to at least enjoy my life and have treats every now and then with my family. I'm like, that's totally fine. You do whatever's right for you, but, you know, something to think about. So she did that mostly. Like, she did a lot, was very meat based and limited carbs and sugar, certainly didn't drink alcohol. And she had, at her, I think it was like a 6 year check, She had no signs of disease. And that, again, is just, it's a single digit 5-year survival rate, GBMs are. Mm-hmm. And so she's in that very, very rare grouping right there. And she's not even doing this full time. She's just sort of has it in the back of her head. And I think since then it has started to recur, but I don't know what she's eating. I don't know. I don't think she's actually practicing a full ketogenic diet. But even with that in the back of her mind and just moving more in that direction, she's had significantly better result than you would see in anywhere in the literature.
Mm-hmm. Do you think cancer is a metabolic disease? I mean,
100%. Yeah. Well, I think with most things in medicine, it's a genetic, you have a genetic predisposition and an environmental trigger. I think that, you just plainly see that there's a significant environmental component when in the 1980s, since the 1980s, and really since the 1977 declaration that cholesterol causes heart disease and saturated fat increases cholesterol, stop eating them. And we radically changed our eating habits in America and the rest of the world. The cancer rates have tripled since then. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, how can we even pretend that this is purely genetic? I mean, there's definitely an exposure response there, because it's tripled. It's tripled in a generation. Like, that certainly isn't genetic. That's not how that works. And so very simply, if you have something in our environment that's causing a tripling of cancer rates, you should be able to identify what it is and take that away. I think it's diet. I think it's because we've changed our diet radically. We've reduced our fat and cholesterol intake by 30%, reduced red meat by 33%, increased fruits and vegetables by 30 and 40% respectively, also increased grains and sugar. And we've had this massive upswing in chronic diseases and cancer in that time. And they all increased at the exact same time. Mm-hmm. And that could just be coincidence, but I don't think it is. And I think we're having more people like Dr. Seyfried showing, you know, very clearly this process. And we have different studies looking at ketogenic diets showing that this increases the efficacy of respiration in our mitochondria and increases our mitochondrial number. And there's now the metabolic theory of cancer, if you will, where we think of this as, like you say, a metabolic disease. And a lot of this goes back to our mitochondria. Are these things, you know, when we have these mitochondria working improperly, we start seeing these cells behave as cancer and actually promoting the genetic changes that we see in cancers as well, as opposed to the other way around, as opposed to we have some sort of, you know, DNA damage, and then that precipitates further mutations, and then you get cancer, and it's purely genetic, where, you know, Seyfried has shown quite clearly that, you know, that it's not purely genetic, that a major driver of this are your mitochondria, and if they're acting dysfunctionally and not able to work properly, and putting people on a ketogenic diet, this has been very clearly shown that this causes you to have more mitochondria and better functioning mitochondria. And so this is likely a main driver in cancer and also cancer treatment, because you're now removing this driver and your cells start working more normally. And people like Seyfried are showing how that works and showing biochemically why that is. So yeah, I absolutely think that it is. I think it's very clear that we have a response to something in our environment. And when you start taking these exposures away from people, they're reversing these diseases, just like autoimmune disorders and diabetes.
Yeah, there's a lot of good evidence for, you know, like I call them lifestyle cancers, but, you know, breast, prostate, uterine in my world, very responsive to ketogenic therapies, and like ovarian cancer, they're looking at ketogenic therapies, very responsive. And not only that, but sensitizing to chemo radiation, not only sensitizing the cancer to chemo radiation, but quality of life is better. The patients are less nauseous. They're like, they feel better through the treatment. So it's going to be awesome to see, you know, where that lies as an adjuvant treatment in the next couple of years. Where do you lie on the debate? I mean, we talked about this basically, if you look in time, as there's, you know, increasing agriculture, more grains, less meat in the diet, there's also a major increase in seed oil production and consumption. Where do you lie in the polyunsaturated fat debate?
Well, I mean, I think that's very clearly going to be contributing to all of this. You know, to what extent, I don't know, but I certainly think it's contributory. We've just simply look at, you know, omega-6s to omega-3 ratio. You have seed oils and plant oils, vegetable oils that have, you know, some of these things have like 600 omega-6s to omega-3s. And, you know, people that don't know, you don't want that. You want more omega-3s than omega-6s. These both they're very similar molecules, and they get broken down by the same enzymes, and well, not broken down, but they get utilized through the same enzyme, and they have very different byproducts that are necessary. You need omega-6s. These are essential, but you need far less than we're getting from the polyunsaturated fats. And so when you have an abundance of omega-6s, that's going to use up all of these enzymes, and you'll get none of the omega-3s that you have aren't really going to get used. The downstream products of omega-6s are very pro-inflammatory. These are the exact, you know, chemicals that our COX inhibitors work on, like aspirin and ibuprofen and, you know, Celebrex. These work on these factors to suppress inflammation. And, you know, so that's causing inflammation. You get an abundance of this, you're getting less omega-3s than you're getting omega-6s byproducts. And these things are very pro-inflammatory. So that's going to cause a problem right there. There are also studies looking at when you substitute polyunsaturated fats like linoleic acid for saturated fats, you do get a reduction in your LDL cholesterol. You also get an increase in cardiac death and overall death. So it's like, that's not really helping. And obviously, I'm in this camp, but I don't know if you are. I would bet that you are, but I don't think that cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, is anything that we need to worry about as far as a marker for disease. The 1977 declaration from the USDA, we now have records going back, and the head of the USDA at the time was a guy who was on the pay of the sugar companies. And there's documentation in the sugar from the sugar industries that the Journal of American Medical Association published in 2015, showing that this guy and a couple of his colleagues from Harvard were paid to falsify data and publish fraudulent studies to make it appear as if cholesterol caused heart disease when it was really sugar.
$50,000 changed the world. Sorry? Forever. It was about $50,000 that they were paid.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, in today's valuation, at the time, it was $6,500. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but equivalent of $50,000 today. Yeah, exactly. And that was what the health of the world was worth to them, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, just amazing to me. And then that guy was made head of the USDA, and he's the one who authored and drove the publication in 1977 to say that, you know, nope, game's over. You know, it was cute that you thought it was sugar, but no, it's definitely cholesterol. And that absolutely, you know, changed the world. And so, you know, we have hard evidence of this, and we have hard evidence that this was fraud. And you look back at their own studies in the Seven Nations study with Ansel Keys, he actually had, you know, the complete data for, I think, like something like 23 countries, and they don't even show a correlation. Now, epidemiological studies can be useful in to a certain degree if you do them well. But they can really, at the best of times, show correlation and never causation. Maybe you can show a strong correlation, such as with smoking and lung cancer. It's like a 15 to 20 times increased association with lung cancer. So it's probably causative, but you can't prove that with that study. But if you show that there isn't a correlation, that proves there is no causation. Okay, so correlation is not causation, but no correlation is
correlation to have causation.
That's it, exactly. And, yeah. And people don't, you know, always remember that. And so their own studies show that there was no correlation between cholesterol and heart disease. So there is no causation. I was in a debate on this with myself and like five cardiologists. You know, I was the only non-cardiologist in this, but I've just spoken out against cholesterol. And that was sort of my, I took it from a history. Everyone was talking about, well, you look at this study and this thing here and these numbers here. And I was just like, look, this isn't even a discussion. Like this, there isn't even a correlation. All these things were based on fraud. And I was like, that's basically the end of this debate. And the other team was so pissed. I said this because wow. It just basically undermined. It didn't matter what they said after that point. Like, it's wrong. It doesn't matter what you say after that point. There's no correlation. There is no causation.
Well, and so I've been ketogenic for 6 years, predominantly carnivore since 2018, and my LDL has gone down. So most cardiologists' heads are spinning, and I'm actually kind of wondering if it's not a good thing, because it's like, the more I read about LDL, it's like, well, I think I want a higher LDL. Like, how do I get this higher? Mine actually went down. It's below 100. But what I run into in my community, and here I am as an OBGYN, I have these patients that come to me and they're like, I'm ketogenic, because I am a boarded ketogenic nutrition specialist. They're like, I'm ketogenic, my LDL skyrocketed, my doctor's pushing statins on me, I don't want to take them. Can you give me your medical opinion? And I'll check a slew of labs, HSCRP, normal, fasting insulin, normal, fasting glucose, normal, triglyceride to HDL ratio, looks beautiful. I mean, we're doing all the things. I can't find anything else wrong with the patient. Okay, fine. Let's go get a coronary artery calcium scan. Okay, score is zero. And, you know, it's like, how can you conceivably tell this patient they need like, you know, 40 milligrams of pravastatin or something? It's just crazy. I don't know. It's an interesting world. Okay. So I'm interested because I practice in the US and you're in Australia. What do your colleagues think of like the way that you eat?
They're interested. You know, a lot of my department like has some people have gone full carnivore. Most of them have at least started eating a lot more meat and limiting the rest of the stuff. Some people just, you know, just the lifestyle aspect with family and friends, it's difficult for them. Some of them, you know, tried to do it, but you know, they're, you know, living with family and who I think they all tried it for about a week and they're like, I can't do this. And so they went back to eating all the other things and, you know, they make, you know, family dinners and group dinners. And so even though they were trying to just do it themselves, it was just a little easier to eat with everyone else. But a lot of other people have gone full carnivore and, most people are quite receptive to it. And they see that, you know, I'm in good shape and I'm eating this way and I'm very happy and healthy and have a lot of energy. And I eat sort of once a day. I don't get tired and I don't, you know, get hangry and just like, oh, boiling to get out of the OR and finish up something so I can desperately run to get something to eat. And they see that and they just go, okay, you know, tell me a little bit more about this. And, you know, one of my bosses, when I first started here, hadn't really operated with him much. And then like one day we were there operating and out of nowhere, he just goes, so I saw, you know, I watched one of your podcasts. I'm like, did you? Like, why would you do that? And he just started asking me about it and just started asking me more. And then we just, you know, had a long conversation throughout this operation. He's just like, yeah, you know, that all makes sense. It all makes sense. Like, yeah. Like, and so, you know, he ended up trying it now. He's doing it as well. And it's really significantly improved his health and happiness. And so, you know, I most people are quite receptive to it. When I first got here, it was a huge vegan push. Like that was the vegan movement in Australia was really strong. And they really took to heart the whole low fat recommendations. They really took that to heart. And to the point that, to the extent that the ranchers here, they've actually bred their cattle to be much more lean because that was just the market. Yeah, that was just the market. And so I was talking to a rancher. They were like, yeah, you can't really get cows to fatten up. Yeah. And so that was it. I was speaking to a beef wholesaler I was getting some meat from. And they were like, I was just like, yeah, no, I want the fattiest stuff that you have. And they're like, that is so refreshing to hear, you know? And because they would have people, they would buy a ribeye loin, right? And if you're buying ribeye, like, you know, you're buying a fatty cut. And so this person bought a ribeye loin and then trimmed out all the fat from inside and outside and brought it back and said, you owe me 3 pounds of meat. And I was just like, Jesus. And they had to like give her a refund. Because she just cut off all his fat. She's like, I don't want this. This is disgusting. How dare you charge me for this? Like, why did you buy ribeye then? Like, that is completely your fault. You don't want a fatty cut. Don't buy a fatty cut. That's just stupid. Yeah. But yeah, they go really, really hard on the low fat, no fat and the vegan push, the vegetarian push. You know, they really took that to heart. They're like, wow, this is the most healthy thing. This is it. I'm going to do it. So what does that say? It says people are very health conscious and they're really thinking about this. Unfortunately, they're just being told the wrong things. And so right. When I first got here, everyone was vegan or going that way. And I would get people just stunned that I only ate meat and they'd be like, wait, you just what? And they would literally look at me like I had three heads and they were just so shocked. And I would end up sort of explaining myself and doing the whole spiel about, you know, plants, you know, using poisons and being toxic and harmful to you and us being carnivores and just giving them this whole spiel 2-3 times a day, every day. I mean, it was just, you run into someone, they would want to know what in God's name you were doing. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people were quite receptive to it. It's since, gained traction now. And so now when I meet people and I'm just eating meat, they're like, oh, that's, if I'm at the hospital and I want to have something to eat, like the restaurant knows my order. So it's got 10 eggs and 6 large pieces of bacon. And people will go up now, they ask for the Anthony breakfast. Can I get the Anthony breakfast? Just eggs and bacon. And they will, and they'll make it for them. And they even preemptively, when they started adding more things on the menu, like a steak sandwich and burger, they actually made an a la carte button just so I could order just the steak, just the meat on its own, and without me even asking. At first, I had to sort of, cajole them into selling me the eggs and bacon separately. And then they're just like, okay, yeah, we're going to put more things. Yeah, we'll just put it separately in case Anthony wants it.
That's awesome.
And so some people will see that and they'll say, I'll have like 3 plates full of eggs and bacon. And they'll be like, Jesus, that's a lot of protein you're going for there. And they'll start asking me about it again. And they're like, oh, wow. And then I'll just say, yeah, I just do a carnivore diet. I don't eat anything else. Now people say like, oh yeah, my brother does that. Or my cousin does that. And now they know someone who does it. Whereas 3 years ago, they just looked at me like I was just some sort of, heretical monster, so it's nice to see that it's gaining traction. But yeah, most people are interested, and they are interested in hearing about it and learning more. And quite a lot of people have taken it on, which is very refreshing to see.
Why do you typically eat one meal and not break it up into two? Just how your schedule works, or
usually? Yeah, I'd like to just make sure that I'm getting enough nutrition, and so I try to eat to satiety. And so if I'm going to eat, I try to eat until I'm full, and I try to make, like, especially at dinner, I'll try to make a little bit more than I think I'm going to want to eat, so I'll intentionally have leftovers, which I'll generally eat the next day, just because I want to make sure that my body's getting enough nutrition. When I was first doing this, sort of jumping back, to my early 20s, when I was taking cancer biology, and just to sort of finish that story and talk about, in relation to the, cancer as well, the reason I stopped eating plants in the first place, because I was taking cancer biology in my undergraduate courses at the University of Washington in Seattle. And we were talking about how plants defend themselves by being poisonous. But, some of these things have been shown to be carcinogenic. And, what does that mean? That means that something's causing inflammation and derangement in your body and in your cells to the extent that this can precipitate cancer 20 years down the line. But it's causing damage the whole time. So this isn't something that's good. Whether or not you ever get cancer, this isn't good for you. This is causing problems in your body. And so we were looking at this from a cancer perspective. And we learned day one that things like, Brussels sprouts had 136 already identified human carcinogens, that, white mushrooms had over 100 known human carcinogens, spinach, kale, lettuce, celery, cabbage, cucumber, broccoli, you name it, 60, 80, or over 100 known human carcinogens each. And they were quite abundant. We know from Professor Bruce Ames from Berkeley in 1989, he published a study looking at just the natural poisons in plants versus the pesticides we were spraying on them, because at the time they were trying to get rid of pesticides, saying, these things are so dangerous. And he just sort of pointed out that we've been using the pesticides for like 80 years without a problem. And so any new problem is likely not from the pesticides. And so he showed that 99.99% of pesticides and insecticides were naturally occurring within the plant, and that so 10,000 times more naturally occurring poisons by weight than the pesticides we spray on them. At this one, they were looking at ALAR, which they were used for apples, and that the naturally occurring poisons were much more likely to cause cancer, like orders of magnitude more likely to cause cancer than the pesticides like ALAR. So that's why we still have pesticides, because they showed that the spinach is worse for you than the pesticides. So we were quite blown away by this. And I remember thinking okay, he must be joking. And we're looking around. No, I don't think he's joking. We're looking for like a TA or something like that. I'd be like snickering in the corner or something. He always does this. But no, there wasn't. And so we all just sort of slowly dawned on us that, okay, this guy is serious. And he was saying, and I remember thinking in my head, I was like, what? But vegetables are still good for you though, right? Like overall. And he just looked at us and he said, I don't eat salad. I don't eat vegetables. I don't let my kids eat vegetables. Plants are trying to kill you. So I was like, all right, screw plants. And I just stopped eating these things. And I went to the grocery store. I just started trying to find things that didn't have plants, which was hard to do. Like everything.
Like, okay, wait, meat and eggs.
That's it. Yeah. And then that's what meat I found. Eggs. I was like, eggs. Okay. Eggs don't come from a plant. Meat doesn't come from a plant. Milk doesn't come from a plant. It's just eggs, meat, milk, and mostly just eggs and meat. And I did that for 5 years while I was playing, while I was in university and playing professionally and, you know, doing all-star, you know,
tournaments. So you were carnivore as a professional rugby player.
Yeah. For like half my career. Yeah. And I literally couldn't get tired. I was able to train so much harder, so much longer, so much better. I don't get sore. I don't get sore now. I didn't get sore then. I didn't think about it at the time, but you know, I was, my exercise potential was so much more, was so much greater. And I could push myself so much harder. And I got so much more out of it as well. And so I got to the point where I was in such phenomenal shape. I literally couldn't get tired. No matter how hard I pushed myself, no matter how long I pushed myself, I couldn't get tired. I remember thinking that I was like, I should just enter a marathon and just, because that could just sprint a marathon. Yeah. And just going, just like, just first marathon out of the gate, just set a world record. I was convinced that I could do this. It just sounded like the most boring thing in the world to me though. So I was like, didn't want to do it. But I remember thinking at the time, I was like, I am really going to regret this if I don't just, you know, timestamp this on how obscenely fit I am right now, because I'm not going to be like this forever. Yeah. And I do regret that. I absolutely regret not doing that. But I remember just like, I was just like, okay, if a marathon pops up in my view, I'll go and run it. But I never really saw any ads for a Seattle marathon or anything. I didn't end up doing it.
That just seems mind blowing to me, because I just feel like Seattle would be like, well, these days I'm sure it's very plant based, like movement.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very much in that direction.
I wonder where this professor is finding his meat and eggs today.
Yeah. Well, I know. That was the thing. I've tried to find this guy subsequently, because, you know, when I sort of rediscovered all of this, you know, several years ago, and I was just like, right, I knew it. Plants were trying to kill me, like get rid of these stupid things, and just completely rearranged my health and fitness. And now I have basically unlimited exercise tolerance again. And I'm, you know, much, much older, 20 years older. And I've actually tried to sort of track him down, but I couldn't actually find in the University of Washington syllabus the name of the professor. And it's really bugging me, because I was trying to track this guy down.
We're going to have to get him on a podcast. Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
definitely.
Okay, well, obviously this has been very refreshing for me, but I do something at all the end of my podcast called the semen analysis. And as you're telling people about the Anthony Chafee breakfast, I'm like, there should be the semen breakfast at the hospital. Everybody will order it. Mass quantities. Because I'm Dr. Semen. So anyway, but I pulled this article, and it's so perfect for this podcast. So it was recently published in the International Journal of General Medicine. It's titled "Total Meat Intake is Associated with Life Expectancy, a Cross-Sectional Data Analysis of 175 Contemporary Populations." And basically the synopsis for all of you is that they looked at 175 different countries, and in the places where meat intake is high, it's positively correlated with life expectancy. But not only that, they controlled for everything, including calorie intake, urbanization, obesity, education, and then carbohydrate crops were also statistically controlled. And in places where there was an increase in carbohydrate crops, it actually showed weak and negative correlation with life expectancy. So right in line with everything that we have talked about on today's podcast, it's pick your poison, but I'm going to stay on the meat train.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that's things like, you know, the Blue Zone study and the Eat Lancet trial, which, you know, people like, you know, Dr. Ioannidis, who's a new professor of medicine at Stanford. And, you know, I think he's one of the top 10 most cited researchers of all time in any field, has said about the Eat Lancet trial, this is more science fiction than science. You know, these are very biased, and they make conclusions that, you know, are not borne out by their own results that they found. And so it's nice to see these things coming out. And, you know, this is something that we could look at, you know, in other ways. I mean, just look at Hong Kong. They eat more pounds of meat per capita
longest life expectancy.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, saying that, oh, no, meat will kill you, that doesn't really bear out in places like Hong Kong. And then you have this study, which, you know, it makes perfect sense to me and to anyone like yourself who studied this at all and scratched the surface at all, that this is actually really the healthiest way for us to live. And, you know, some people say it's like, well, you know, this is, you know, a meat-based diet is, you know, is really good when you're younger, if you want to like burn out young and, you know, and live fast, die young and leave a pretty corpse. But, you know, if you want longevity, then you need to eat something else. Like, why would that make any sense? You know, why would something
A lot of the work of David Sinclair, he's very low protein, not necessarily anti-meat, but very like low protein. And I don't agree with it. Your NAD ratios are better in a ketogenic state. You're upregulating sirtuin genes. It's a warm study, but shows an increase in telomere length. I mean, if you look at pictures of me from 6 years ago, it's like reverse aging, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, it's same with myself, same with my parents. My parents look, you know, 10 years younger than they did before they started doing this. They've all lost weight. They're so much more active and healthy, and they're 80 now. And, you know, my dad was, you know, I was talking to my brother on the phone, you know, 8 months after my dad went carnivore, and he was before that, he was basically had enough energy to go from his bedroom to the couch and watch TV and then back again. And he really wasn't very much more active than that. And it was quite worrying. 8 months after he was on a carnivore diet, I was talking to my brother and he says like, oh yeah, I'm going over to mom and dad's house. And I said, okay, are we just going over to say hi or what's going on? I said, well, you know, I didn't plan on it, but, you know, mom called me and said that dad was outside with the chainsaw trying to cut down some trees. And she just wanted me to make sure that he didn't kill himself. So I'm going over there. And so that's a very good sign. You know, this guy's got enough energy. Like I'm going to go start, you know, cutting some lumber. You know,
chainsaws are not easy to operate. Like they're heavy and dangerous.
Yeah. And so are trees. And, you know, so, you know, and you look at native populations and people just discount these and discredit them because they're, you know, they're not an official government timestamped, you know, birth certificate. Fine. But you know, they're their own records and who's to say that they're wrong. And you know, Native Americans were, you know, saying they were routinely living to be 110, 115 years old. Same with the Inuits, same with the, you know, the different, you know, Siberian tribes that just herd caribou and only eat meat. The Maasai in Africa would routinely live well over 100 in very, very good shape. We have going back historically, you know, have, you know, Herodotus, the first Greek historian, had an account between the Persian Empire going down to visit the Ethiopian kingdom, and chronicled this, and you know, maybe this was you know, braggadocious, but you know, this is in the historical record. The king of Ethiopia asked the Persian emissary, said like, you know, what does your emperor eat? What do your people normally live to? And they discussed the making of wheat and the making of bread, or growing of wheat and the making of bread. And they said that, you know, our people would normally eat, you know, the bread, and they would live about 70 years. And the king of Ethiopia said, well, no wonder you people live such short lives. If you eat dirt, you know, we only eat boiled meat and drink the milk, and we only drink the milk of our cattle, and we would live 120 years, some people longer than that. And maybe that sounds braggadocious, and maybe this was inaccurate, and he was just trying to show off, maybe. But we know as geneticists that genetically, we are designed as humans to live on average 120 years. So it's bang on what we know as geneticists, that we are supposed to live 120 years. And what does that mean? That means that if you just stay out of your own way and just don't mess up, you should live 120 years without doing anything special. And yet we're dying in our 60s and 70s. Why is that? And I think that's from the slow poison of the things that we're eating. And so if you're eating your natural diet, if you're eating what you evolved on, what's biologically appropriate, then you should live to your biologically appropriate, genetically designed life expectancy, which is 120 years. And all of the best evidence shows that humans are carnivores and have been carnivores for the last 2.5 to 3 million years. Stable isotope studies have shown that conclusively. And, you know, so I don't think that there's You know, I think that it's nice to have these studies, but I think that you can prove this well and truly long before you even have them. But it's very, very good to see them get into the mainstream literature as well.
Yeah. I felt like when I first entered the ketogenic space, I was like the black sheep. There was people that said I should have like my medical license reviewed. I think it will be very interesting in the next 10, 15, 20 years, you know, will politics prevail with all of this, or will people just finally get their head out of the sand and take more personal accountability? It's going to be interesting. But to bring this podcast completely full circle, when we started, you were talking about animals and animal species specific diets. My husband and I got a dog in college, and we were young and stupid and didn't have a lot of money. So we fed it normal kibble from the store. And they told us the dog on average would live 12 to 15 years. And he died at age 10 of horrible diabetes. He was in liver, renal failure, had cataracts and horrible neuropathy. Like neuropathy so bad, if you tried to pick him up off the couch, he would like try to bite you because his legs hurt so bad. And so he died at age 10. And then like a year or two later, our other dog died of renal failure. And I'm like, oh my God, like it's gotta be something in the food. And this was like right around the time that I went ketogenic, and I found all the literature from Keto Pet Sanctuary, which is this place in Texas that takes these dogs with terminal cancer, and they put them on ketogenic diets, and they like their cancers like shrink and go away. And they live like multiple years, like just running around on this like awesome farm in Texas. And they ended up creating a ketogenic kibble, a ketogenic dog food, totally shelf stable. And so, we have two new dogs now, but they're carnivores, and they, oh my God, they love meat. They eat the carnivore dog treats, and they just, yeah, it's, they're totally different dogs. Like their coats are healthier. I feel bad about our first dog, but we didn't know any better at the time. So it's,
It is. Yeah. My dog was the same. You know, I absolutely adored this dog. I still miss her. She's a little yellow Labrador, and she died when she was 8 of liver failure. She shouldn't have died then, you know? And I remember thinking when we were first feeding her kibble, I was a teenager, and I was looking, I was like, you know, dogs are wolves. Wolves eat meat. You know, is this supposed to be what they're eating? And they just like, well, you know, this is dog food. They call it dog food. They know what dogs are supposed to eat, I guess. And I didn't think of it past that. And I really wish that I had. And I had the first instinct was like, is this the right thing? And I really wish that I had listened to that, because she would have been much, much healthier and lived much longer. And it was very sad that she didn't. But you know, this is something that we can absolutely change. I mean, you know, dogs are carnivores. That's just what they are. And cats are as well. And you know, actually, similar story. I had a family cat as well. And the poor little guy got lung cancer, had this big tumor. And one of his lungs was just completely full of cancer. And so it was hard for him to breathe. He would cough a lot. I came back from medical school, I think my first year, and this cat was just completely cachectic. I mean, he looked like just a corpse, and he was just going to die any day. And, you know, he wouldn't eat any of the kibble and even like the wet food he really didn't like. And so he just wouldn't eat. And my mom was like, yeah, you just can't eat it. But, you know, she had some drippings from a roast chicken that she made, the sort of the gelatinous, you know, drippings. And, you know, he would eat that. And I was like, well, okay, well just feed him that then. And so she did. She started doing that. And like every day she'd make a roast, and she would actually overcook it to drain more of the juices out of it. And she would just give that to him. He put on weight. He so ended up looking like a normal cat. He lived another 2 years.
Oh my God.
You know? And that's what they teach in medical school, is, you know, in pathology and getting ready for the USMLEs, is, you know, you cannot put on weight when you have cancer, because of the tumor necrosis factor alpha. This just drains your body of energy. You cannot out eat the TNF alpha. You just can't do it. Well, I've seen them do it if you're eating the right things. Mm-hmm. And if you're allowing your body's processes to work naturally,
works. They're starting to show now in hospital bedridden patients, like in the ICU, if you put them in therapeutic ketosis, it actually protects against, you know, sarcopenia from diseases and cancer cachexia. Oh. I mean, it's like, we're showing it in humans now.
Awesome. Yeah. And hopefully this just keeps getting, you know, the Harvard study came out, which, you know, it's a survey, and that can only show certain things, but it was very promising. And I think that will open the door to other more robust studies to show the efficacy of this and actually get it, you know, start treating people with it. And, you know, like I was saying before, I don't think that most of these, you know, diseases, especially the chronic diseases that we treat, are actually diseases. I think that they're toxicities, and you know, the way that you deal with lead poisoning is not figuring out a new novel drug for $1 billion that sort of slows down the process and degradation of your body from the lead, and so you can die slowly over 40 years. You maybe use a chelating agent, but you also just remove the lead. And so once we mainstream popularize that this is what's happening, this is an exposure response, and we get the exposure away from people, you know, then we'll start treating this for what it is, which is a poisoning. We get rid of that and we start giving people our proper nutrition. Then our lives as doctors are going to get, they're going to get a lot easier. They're going to go back to what they were, which is dealing with, you know, pregnancy and childbirth, childhood, congenital genetic issues, you know, infections, traumas, and then, you know, much less poisoning, you know, which is still what we're treating now. We have the 6-1 chronic disease, but really that's the 5th one, poisoning, I think. And so once we shrink down the poisoning side of things, then we can actually get back to the basic four. And I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to doctors having a lot less to do and being much more bored. I'd be very happy when that happens.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Chafee, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to let you get on with your day and I'm going to go to bed and get my sleep. But this has been very enlightening and refreshing. And so thank you, everybody, for listening to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. If you think somebody would find this helpful, make sure you share it with them. Make sure you go leave us your reviews. Seriously, you don't know how much that helps us get the word out more. So Dr. Chafee, thank you. I hope we connect again soon.
I appreciate it. And thank you very much, Dr. Seaman. I appreciate the opportunity to come on.